but in one key respect, they deviated from English practice. They did not disinherit their younger sons, with whom Tidewater gentlemen often felt a special bond. Most had come to America precisely because they were themselves the disinherited younger sons of country gentlemen. Tidewater's aspiring gentry created a thoroughly rural society without towns or even villages. It had no need for commercial ports, and thus for cities, because the land was riven with navigable fingers of the Chesapeake, allowing each of the great planters to build his own dock. On clearing customs, ocean-going ships could sail directly to a plantation, unload the latest books, fashions, and furniture from London, and load barrels of tobacco. Later, slaves would also arrive in this way. Anything may be delivered to a gentleman in Virginia from London, Bristol, and etc., with less trouble and cost than to one living 5 miles in country in England, one English observer remarked. Few local manufacturers could compete with cheaply sourced English goods, discouraging craftsmen and industry. There were no towns at all until the end of the 17th century, apart from Jamestown and St. Mary's City, and even these twin capitals remained little more than villages with a few hundred inhabitants each. Gentlemen would travel to them occasionally to convene their assembly, or perhaps make a rare call on the governor, but otherwise had little to do with them. Both capitals were crude and appeared abandoned when the provincial assembly was out of session, with many houses uninhabited and the taverns empty. New capitals would eventually be built in Williamsburg and Annapolis, but they, too, were government campuses, not urban communities. In sharp contrast to New England, there were no public schools, gentlemen's children had live-in tutors, or town governments. The county courthouse sufficed. By the early 1700s, the Cavaliers and their descendants had turned Tidewater into a country gentleman's utopia, their manors lining the creeks and tributaries of the Chesapeake. Plantations were also taking shape on Albemarle and Pamlico Sounds in the new colony of North Carolina, and on the Atlantic shores of southern Delaware and the lower Delmarva Peninsula. Power in Tidewater had become hereditary. The leading families intermarried in both America and England, creating a close-linked cousinage that dominated Tidewater generally, and Virginia in particular. The Virginia Royal Council served as that colony's Senate, Supreme Court, and Executive Cabinet, and it controlled the distribution of land. By 1724, every single council member was related by blood or marriage. Two generations later, on the eve of the American Revolution, every member was descended from a councillor who had served in 1660. In the interceding century, they rewarded one another with the majority of the public lands under the colony's control and appointments to the very lucrative post of collector of customs. At the county level, gentlemen controlled the distribution of justice and charity in their roles as justices of the peace and could hire and fire pastors at will from their seats on the church vestry. One newcomer recalled a gentleman's warning him, "against disobliging or offending any person of note in the colony, because, either by blood or marriage, we are almost all related, and so connected in our interests that whoever of a stranger presumes to offend any one of us will infallibly find an enemy of the whole." Running afoul of Tidewater gentlemen was a dangerous proposition. Late 17th and early 18th century visitors constantly remarked on their haughty sense of personal honor and their furious reaction to the slightest insult. While the Yankee elite generally settled their disputes through the instrument of written laws, Tidewater gentry were more likely to resort to a duel. Commoners were equally prideful. Arguments in the tavern commonly led to nasty fights, in which it was acceptable to kick, bite, strangle, gouge out eyes, and dismember genitals of one's opponent. Lower-status people almost never challenged their betters for fear of savage retribution, as gentlemen could have lesser persons whipped for minor offenses. When one commoner spoke out against a governor, a court ordered that he be brutally beaten by 40 men, be fined £200, a decade's income for a peasant, have a hole bored through his tongue, and then be forever banished from Virginia. Indeed, cases that came to court were resolved by gentlemen judges, who believed that issues should be decided by their own sense of justice, rather than by precedents written in law books, even in matters of life and death, Court records show a clear pattern. Leniency for masters and males, harsh sentences for servants and women. Even before the spread of full-fledged slavery, Tidewater's hierarchy was maintained by the threat of violence. One might ask how such a tyrannical society could have produced some of the greatest champions of republicanism, such as Thomas Jefferson, George Washington, and James Madison. The answer is that Tidewater's gentry embraced classical republicanism, meaning a republic modeled after those of ancient Greece and Rome. They emulated the learned, slaveholding elite of ancient Athens, basing their enlightened political philosophies around the ancient Latin concept of libertas, or liberty. This was a fundamentally different notion from the Germanic concept of Freiheit, or freedom, which informed the political thought of Yankeedom and the Midlands. Understanding the distinction is essential to comprehending the fundamental disagreements that still plague relations between Tidewater, the Deep South and New Spain, on one hand, and Yankeedom and the Midlands on the other. For the Norse, Anglo-Saxons, Dutch, and other Germanic tribes of northern Europe, freedom was a birthright of free peoples, which they considered themselves to be. Individuals might have differences in status and wealth, but all were literally born free. All were equal before the law, and all had come into the world possessing rights that had to be mutually respected on threat of banishment. Tribes had the right to rule themselves through assemblies like Iceland's Althingi, recognized as the world's oldest parliament. Until the Norman invasion of 1066, the Anglo-Saxon tribes of England had ruled themselves in this manner. After the invasion, the lords of Normandy imposed manorial feudalism on England, but they never fully did away with the free institutions of the Anglo-Saxon and Gaelo-Norse Scots, which survived in village councils, English common law, and the House of Commons. It was this tradition that the Puritans carried to Yankeedom. The Greek and Roman political philosophy embraced by Tidewater gentry assumed the opposite. Most humans were born into bondage. Liberty was something that was granted and was thus a privilege, not a right. Some people were permitted many liberties, others had very few, and many had none at all. The Roman Republic was one in which only a handful of people had the full privileges of speech, senators, magistrates. A minority had the right to vote on what their superiors had decided, citizens. And most people had no say at all, slaves. Liberties were valuable because most people did not have them and were thought meaningless without the presence of a hierarchy. For the Greeks and Romans, there was no contradiction between republicanism and slavery, liberty and bondage. This was the political philosophy embraced and jealously guarded by Tidewater's leaders, whose high-born family saw themselves as descendants not of the common Anglo-Saxons, but rather of their aristocratic Norman conquerors. It was a philosophical divide with racial overtones, and one that would later drive America's nations into all-out war with one another. Tidewater's leaders imposed libertas on their society in countless ways. They referred to themselves as heads of their respective manors, dictating duties to their hands and other subservient appendages. Finding Jamestown and St. Mary's City too crude, they built new government campuses in Williamsburg and Annapolis from central plans inspired by Rome. Williamsburg featured a sumptuous formal palace for the governor, surrounded by Versailles-like formal gardens, and the elegant capitol, not state house, decorated with a relief of Jupiter, the god whose temple stood at the center of Roman civic life. They named counties, cities, and colonies after their superiors. English royals, Prince George, Prince William, Princess Anne, Jamestown, Williamsburg, Annapolis, Georgetown, Virginia, Maryland, or high nobles, Albemarle, Baltimore, Beaufort, Calvert, Cecil, Cumberland, Caroline, Anne Arundel, Delaware. While they were passionate in defending their liberties, it would never have occurred to them that those liberties might be shared with their subjects. "I am an aristocrat," Virginian John Randolph would explain decades after the American Revolution. "I love liberty. I hate equality." While the gentry enjoyed ever greater liberties, including leisure, liberty from work, and independence, liberty from control of others, those at the bottom of the hierarchy had progressively fewer. Tidewater's semi-feudal model required a vast and permanent underclass to play the role of serfs, on whose toil the entire system depended. But from the 1670s onward, the gentry had an increasingly difficult time finding enough poor Englishmen willing to take on this role. Those who completed their indentures often could not support themselves in an agricultural export economy increasingly dominated by great plantations, and ex-servants led or joined rebellions in 1663, 1675, and 1683. Slave traders offered a solution to this shortage, one developed on the English islands of the Caribbean and recently introduced in the settlements they'd created in the Deep South. The purchase of people of African descent, who could become permanent property of their masters, as would their children and grandchildren. This slave caste grew from a tenth of Tidewater's population in 1700 to a quarter in 1720 and 40% in 1760. As one scholar would later put it, the South was not founded to create slavery. Slavery was recruited to perpetuate the South. As we will see, this statement does not hold true for the South as a whole, but rather for the distinct cultural nation of Tidewater. It was a strategy that would set Tidewater on a path to destruction. Chapter 4. Founding Yankeedom. By a twist of history, the dominant colonies of New England were founded by men who stood in total opposition to nearly every value that Tidewater gentry held dear. Hostile to landed aristocracy, noble privilege, the Anglican Church, and the Royalist cause, the Pilgrims of Cape Cod and the Puritans of Massachusetts Bay had an entirely different vision for their new society. A moralistic nation of churches and schoolhouses, where each community functioned as its own self-governing republic, Yankeedom would leave an indelible mark on a vast swath of the continent. The Pilgrims, and to a greater extent the Puritans, came to the New World not to recreate rural English life, but rather to build a completely new society, an applied religious utopia, a Protestant theocracy based on the teachings of John Calvin. They would found a new Zion in the New England wilderness, a city on a hill, to serve as a model for the rest of the world in those troubled times. They believed they would succeed because they were God's chosen people, bound to Him in an Old Testament-style covenant. If they did all His will, they would be rewarded. If any member did not, they might all be punished. In early Massachusetts, there was no such thing as minding one's own business. The salvation of the entire community depended on everyone doing their part. According to a central myth of American history, the founders of Yankeedom were champions of religious freedom fleeing persecution at home. While there is some truth to this in regard to the Pilgrims, a few hundred English Calvinists who settled Cape Cod in 1620, it is entirely false in regard to the Puritans of Massachusetts Bay, who would soon bring Plymouth and other colonies of New England under their control. The Puritans left England en masse in the 1630s, 25,000 in just 12 short years, because of their unwillingness to compromise on matters of religious policy. While other colonies welcomed all comers, the Puritans forbade anyone to settle in their colony who failed to pass a test of religious conformity. Dissenters were banished. Quakers were disfigured for easy identification, their nostrils slit, their ears cut off, their faces branded with the letter H for heretic. Puritans doled out death sentences for infractions such as adultery, blasphemy, idolatry, sodomy, and even teenage rebellion. They fined farmers who tended their cows, raked hay, or hunted birds on the Sabbath. Boston magistrates put Captain Thomas Kemble in the stocks in 1656 because, having returned from a 3-year absence, he kissed his wife at his doorstep. Lewd and unseemly behavior, in the eyes of the court. Early Yankeedom was less tolerant of moral or religious deviance than the England its settlers had left behind. but in other respects the Puritans created a genuinely revolutionary society. Having secured, through deception, a royal charter for their colony, they were not beholden to feudal nobles, as were early Maryland and New France, or distant corporations, as were Virginia and later the Carolinas. New Englanders intended to rule themselves. Nearly half of Yankeedom's early settlers came from East Anglia, the most economically sophisticated part of the British Isles. Its seven easternmost counties were the most densely settled, urbanized, and educated part of England, with a burgeoning middle class and a long history of rebellion against arbitrary rule. It was a region profoundly influenced by the Netherlands, the most commercially and politically advanced nation in Europe, which lay just across the English Channel. Dutch Calvinism, republicanism, agriculture, architecture, art, and commerce had left their mark on the region, which had tulip gardens, gabled houses, and a highly literate population of artisans, craftsmen, and yeoman farmers. Champions of the Germanic notions of freedom, East Anglians participated in town meetings and chose selectmen to run local affairs. Not surprisingly, the region would strongly support Parliament against the king in the English Civil War. Many of these East Anglian characteristics were transplanted to New England. The Puritan exodus had a demographic character entirely unlike that of Tidewater, New France, and El Norte. The Yankee settlers came as families and were generally middle class, well-educated, and roughly equal in material wealth. While Tidewater was settled largely by young, unskilled male servants, New England's colonists were skilled craftsmen, lawyers, doctors, and yeoman farmers. None of them was an indentured servant. Rather than having fled poverty in search of better lives, the early Yankees had traded a comfortable existence at home for the uncertainties of the wilderness. 70% came as part of an established family, giving early Yankeedom far more typical gender and age ratios than then of the other nations. This demographic advantage, and the fact that New England had relatively few epidemic diseases, enabled the population to expand rapidly from its initial settlement base. Although few immigrants entered the region for a century after 1640, colonial New England's European population doubled every generation. By 1660, it had reached 60,000, more than twice the population of Tidewater, which had a generation's head start. The largest population center north of the Rio Grande, Yankeedom was already the most cohesive, given that nearly everyone had arrived at the same time and for much the same reasons. The Puritan emigrants were not led by high-born nobles or gentlemen. Virtually none ever came to Yankeedom, but by an elite distinguished by education. These men possessed, in proportion to their number, a greater mass of intelligence than is to be found in any European nation of our own time. The French aristocrat Alexis de Tocqueville wrote of early New England in 1835. All, perhaps without exception, have received a good education, and many of them were well known in Europe for their talents and achievements. The Puritans had been hostile to royal and aristocratic prerogative at home, and continued to be so in America. From the beginning, Yankeedom was opposed to the creation of a landed aristocracy and suspicious of inherited privilege and the conspicuous display of wealth. Unique among the colonies, its leaders didn't hand out massive swaths of land to friends, family, and allies, so the latter could become rich by retailing lots out to others. Instead, the Puritans gave town charters to approved groups of settlers, who in turn elected a committee of their peers to select the location of the public road, church, schoolhouse, and town green, and to divvy up family lots. While larger or wealthier families might have been granted larger lots, the division was surprisingly egalitarian. The townspeople often named settlements for the eastern English towns they'd left behind, Haverhill, Ipswich, and Groton, all in Suffolk, Springfield, Malden, and Braintree, in Essex, Lynn, Hingham, and Newton, in Norfolk, and the southern Lincolnshire port of Boston. Townspeople were supposed to work together toward the common good of their community. Squabbling over land and other material things was thought a distraction from their true calling before God. The New England settlement model differed from Tidewater not merely in the presence of towns, but in the power vested in them. Puritans believed every community of the chosen should govern itself without interference from bishops, archbishops, or kings. Every congregation was to be completely self-governing. Worldly matters were to be dealt with in exactly the same way. Every town was to be a little republic unto itself, with total control over the enforcement of laws, the administration of schools and real estate, the collection of, and, for the most part, spending of taxes, and the organization of militias for self-defense. While counties had almost no powers at all, every town had its own government, a group of selectmen elected by the adult male members of the church. The selectmen acted as a plural executive, while the town's eligible voters gathered for town meetings and functioned as a miniature parliament. Although New England was an intolerant and in many ways authoritarian place to live, it was, by the standards of the age, shockingly democratic. 60 to 70% of adult males, or 30 to 35% of the total adult population, had the right to vote, and the rich and well-born were given no special privileges, either in politics or before the law. This tradition of self-government, local control, and direct democracy has remained central to Yankee culture. To this day, rural communities across New England still control most local affairs through an annual town meeting, at which every expenditure is debated and voted on, not by an elected representative, but by the inhabitants themselves. Indeed, Yankees would come to have faith in government to a degree incomprehensible to people of the other American nations. Government, New Englanders believed from the beginning, could defend the public good from the selfish machinations of moneyed interests. It could enforce morals through the prohibition or regulation of undesirable activities. It could create a better society through public spending on infrastructure and schools. More than any other group in America, Yankees conceive of government as being run by and for themselves. Everyone is supposed to participate, and there is no greater outrage than to manipulate the political process for private gain. Yankee idealism never died. The Puritan belief that each individual had to encounter divine revelation through reading the scriptures had far-reaching implications. If everyone was expected to read the Bible, everyone had to be illiterate. Public schoolhouses, therefore, were built and staffed by salaried teachers as soon as a new town was established. While the other American nations had no school systems of any kind in the mid-17th century, education was a privilege of the rich. New England required all children to be sent to school under penalty of law. While few Englishmen could read or write in 1660, two-thirds of Massachusetts men and more than a third of women could sign their own names. And while basic education was universal, those with higher education were accorded the sort of respect and deference other societies reserved for the highborn. Early New England had an elite, a group of leading families who intermarried and came to dominate political and religious affairs. But it was an elite based not on wealth, but education. Of the original 15,000 settlers who came to Massachusetts Bay, at least 129 were graduates of Oxford or Cambridge, a shockingly high figure for the age. Virtually all of them assumed leadership roles. None of the men who served as governors in early Massachusetts or Connecticut was a noble, but many had graduated from the English universities, or Harvard, a homegrown alternative founded just 6 years after the first Puritans had arrived. It was instituted, according to a 1645 brochure, to advance learning and perpetuate it to posterity, dreading to leave an illiterate ministry to the churches. Boston today is said to be the intellectual capital of the continent. Indeed, it has been so since its very foundation. If the Puritans had kept to themselves, their neighbors might have taken little notice of them. But what would cause Yankeedom eventually to be so loathed by the other nations was its desire, indeed its mission, to impose its ways on everyone else. For the Puritans didn't merely believe they were God's chosen people. They believed God had charged each and every one of them to propagate his will on a corrupt and sinful world. All Yankee Calvinists were thought to have a calling, a vocation through which they would, priest-like, further God's work. They had to be constantly vigilant in the performance of their calling, be it a missionary, a merchant, or a cobbler. Idleness was ungodly. Personal wealth was expected to be reinvested in one's good works, professional or philanthropic, to bring the world in closer accord with the divine plan. Other societies and cultures would presumably see the light on the hill and wish to conform. Woe be to those who did not. The Puritans tended to be affronted by and fearful of otherness, which could make them rather dangerous to have as one's neighbors. They especially feared the wilderness, a disorderly, impulsive place at the edge of their fields where Satan lurked, ready to tempt those who wandered too far from the watchful eyes of the community. The people of the forest, the Native Americans of New England, had clearly fallen under devilish influence, what with their unrestrained manners, open sexuality, skimpy clothing, belief in spirits, and disrespect for the Sabbath. Unlike the settlers in New France, the Puritans regarded the Indians as savages, to whom normal moral obligations, respective treaties, fair dealing, foregoing the slaughter of innocents, did not apply. When a group of dissatisfied Puritan settlers marched into the wilderness to found a squatter's colony called Connecticut in 1636, Massachusetts authorities engineered a genocidal war against the Pequot Indians, so as to have a pretext to seize the region from under the squatters by conquest. In one notorious incident, they surrounded a poorly defended Pequot village and butchered virtually every man, woman, and child they found there, mostly by burning them alive. The slaughter was shocking to the Puritans' temporary Indian allies, the Narragansetts, who called it too furious. Plymouth Governor William Bradford conceded that it had been a fearful sight to see them thus frying in the fire and the streams of blood quenching the same, but concluded that the victory seemed a sweet sacrifice, which God had wrought so wonderfully for them. Full-scale conflicts with the Indians continued throughout the colonial period, many of them made worse by the Puritan practice of attacking a neutral or friendly tribe while at war with another. Captured Indian children were killed or sold to slaveholders in the English Caribbean. Puritan preacher William Hubbard endorsed this practice, seeing the seizure of so many young serpents of the same brood as another sign of divine favor to the English. The Puritans' program of conquest was not limited to Indian peoples. During and immediately after the English Civil War, Massachusetts soldiers and preachers attempted Yankee coups in Maryland and the Bahamas, annexed the Royalist colony of Maine, and reduced Connecticut, Plymouth, and New Hampshire to mere satellites of their Bible Commonwealth. For 4 decades, Boston ruled the region as the capital of the United Colonies of New England, a confederation that incorporated all the Yankee settlements save those in Rhode Island. Puritan courts enforced Calvinist morality on hard-living Maine fishermen and drove Anglican priests from New Hampshire. Here were the kernels of the twin political ideologies of America's imperial age, American exceptionalism and manifest destiny. The first held that Americans were God's chosen people, the second that he wished Americans to rule the continent from sea to sea. Both ideas had their origins in Yankee Puritan thought and would be developed and championed by the sons of New England. The concepts would remain popular in Yankeedom until the early 19th century, when it became clear that their own culture would not dominate the United States as it had in New England. To Yankee frustration, the other nations would actively resist their hegemony. From the outset, the Yankees were opposed to the very values cherished by the aristocratic society taking shape in Tidewater, including their Norman cultural identity. When the English Civil War broke out, hundreds of Puritans returned home to fight in Oliver Cromwell's New Model Army, a military force founded on the radical notion that promotions should be based on proficiency rather than social status. As they clashed with royalist armies, they grew to believe they were fighting to liberate their Anglo-Saxon lands from the Norman invaders 600 years after the latter had arrived with William the Conqueror. "What were the lords of England?" a group of common soldiers declared to a wartime visitor to their encampment, "but William the Conqueror's colonies." King Charles, they decreed, was the last successor of William the Conqueror, who had to be cast out if the people were to have recovered ourselves from under the Norman yoke. the soldiers drew up a lofty document called the Agreement of the People, which asserted their natural freedom, called for every parish to select its own clergy, and demanded an end to aristocratic privileges before the law. "Our very laws were made by our conquerors," one New Model Army veteran asserted. "We are now engaged for our freedom." Tensions with Tidewater did not end with the English Civil War. The New Model Army's victory and the military dictatorship that followed sparked the Cavalier exodus to Virginia, while freeing the Puritans of Massachusetts to annex their neighbors. For Tidewater gentry, New England, complicit in a treasonous rebellion and the execution of the king, was a seditious land populated by radicals committed to destroying the foundations on which society stood. For Yankees, Tidewater was a bastion of reactionary forces, its lords committed to perpetuating the enslavement of the English people begun by their Norman ancestors. Their fears were given new urgency after Cromwell's death in 1658 when, in short order, the monarchy was restored, and a Cavalier Parliament of Royalist sympathizers convened in Westminster. The gentlemen of Virginia and the Calverts of Maryland once again had the backing of London, and the Puritans faced a mortal threat to their young nation. America's English colonies were rushing toward their first revolution, but first there were some foreigners to contend with. Chapter 5. Founding New Netherland. Most Americans know the Dutch founded what is now Greater New York City. Few realize that their influence is largely the reason New York is New York, the most vibrant and powerful city on the continent, and one with a culture and identity unlike that of any place else in the United States. Incredibly, its salient features developed when Manhattan was still largely a wilderness, and the greatest city on earth was but a tiny village clinging to the island's southern tip. New Netherland was founded in 1624, just 4 years after the Mayflower voyage, and 6 years ahead of the Puritans' arrival in Massachusetts Bay. Its capital and principal settlement, New Amsterdam, was clustered around the wooden Fort Amsterdam, which stood where the Museum of the American Indian is now located, next to Battery Park and Bowling Green, where the Dutch had their cattle market. When New Amsterdam was conquered by the English in 1664, the city extended only as far as Wall Street, where, in fact, the Dutch had built a wall. The main road, Brede Weg, Broadway, passed through a gate in the wall and continued on past farms, fields, and forests to the village of Haarlem on the north end of the island. Ferrymen rode goods and people across the East River to Lange Eiland and the villages of Berukelen, Brooklyn, Vlissingen, Flushing, Vlekkebos, Flatbush, and New Utrecht, now a Brooklyn neighborhood, or across the harbor to Hoboken and Staten Eiland. The area had but 1,500 inhabitants. But this small village was already unlike anywhere else in North America. Established as a fur trading post, it was an unabashedly commercial settlement with little concern for either social cohesion or the creation of a model society. A global corporation, the Dutch West India Company, dominated the city's affairs and formally governed New Netherland for the first few decades. Standing between Yankeedom and Tidewater, the city had emerged as a trading entrepot for both. Its markets, ships, and warehouses filled with Virginia tobacco, New England salt cod, Indian-caught beaver pelts, linens, dishes, and other manufactured goods from the mother country, and produce from the farms of Harlem and Brooklyn. Its population was equally diverse, including French-speaking Walloons, Lutherans from Poland, Finland, and Sweden, Catholics from Ireland and Portugal, and Anglicans, Puritans, and Quakers from New England. Jews were banned from setting foot in New France, Yankeedom, and Tidewater, but dozens of Ashkenazim and Spanish-speaking Sephardim settled in New Amsterdam in the 1650s, forming the nucleus of what would eventually become the largest Jewish community in the world. Indians roamed the streets, and Africans, slave, free, and half-free, already formed a fifth of the population. A Muslim from Morocco had been farming outside the walls for 3 decades. Visitors were shocked by the village's religious, ethnic, and linguistic diversity. In 1643, Father Isaac Jogues, a Jesuit working in New France, estimated New Amsterdam's population at 500 and the number of its languages at 18. An arrogance of Babel that has done much harm to all men. The different ethnic and national groups often kept to themselves and squabbled with one another for power, with not even the Dutch forming a majority within the settlement. The local elite was comprised almost entirely of self-made men who'd risen from humble origins in the worlds of commerce and real estate speculation. The government, desirous above all to promote trade, embraced diversity even as it eschewed democracy. The village was, to put it simply, New York, and many of its characteristics have endured to the present day. These characteristics, diversity, tolerance, upward mobility, and an overwhelming emphasis on private enterprise, have come to be identified with the United States, but they were really the legacy of the United Provinces of the Netherlands. Indeed, many of the historic achievements of the American Revolution were accomplished by the Dutch nearly 2 centuries before the Battle of Lexington. A successful war of independence against an enormous monarchical empire, the Kingdom of Spain. The declaration of an inborn human right to rebel against an oppressive government, the 1581 Act of Abjuration, and the creation of a kingless republic. In the early 1600s, the Netherlands was the most modern and sophisticated country on earth, producing art, laws, business practices, and institutions that became the standards for the rest of the Western world. They invented modern banking, creating at the Bank of Amsterdam the first clearinghouse for the disparate coins and currencies of the world, all exchangeable for Dutch florins, which became the preferred medium of international exchange. In 1602, they invented the global corporation with the establishment of the Dutch East India Company, which soon had hundreds of ships, thousands of employees, and extensive operations in Indonesia, Japan, India, and southern Africa. Shareholders were drawn from all levels of society, wealthy merchants to maidservants and day laborers, fostering broad social support for the company's enterprises. Dutch ocean-going ships, 10,000 of them in 1600, were of advanced design and dominated the shipping of northern Europe. By the time the Dutch West India Company founded New Amsterdam, the Netherlands had assumed a role in the world economy equivalent to that of the United States in the late 20th century, setting the standards for international business, finance, and law. Uniquely among the people of 17th century Europe, the Dutch were committed to free inquiry. Their universities were second to none, attracting thinkers from countries where the use of reason was curtailed. Among the émigré intellectuals living in Holland was René Descartes, the French philosopher who believed inquiry should be based on good sense rather than the authority of the Bible or the philosophers of antiquity. His ideas would form the basis of modern science, and they were first published in the Netherlands, as was Galileo's Discourses and Mathematical Demonstrations Concerning Two New Sciences, 1638, a book that could never have been approved by the Pope's censors back in Italy, and that effectively founded modern physics. Baruch Spinoza, an Amsterdam-born Sephardic Jew who had been excommunicated by his rabbi, published philosophical texts that have been credited with inspiring everything from biblical criticism to deep ecology. While in exile in Amsterdam, John Locke composed his A Letter Concerning Toleration, 1689, which argued for a separation of church and state. Dutch scientists invented the telescope and microscope and used them to discover everything from the rings of Saturn to the existence of sperm cells. They were able to share their discoveries and ideas with the world because Dutch officials accepted the freedom of the press. Modern scholars have estimated that Dutch printers were responsible for half of all the books published in the 17th century. The Netherlands' tiny oasis of intellectual freedom, squeezed between the North Sea and the Catholic Inquisition, was the incubator for the modern world. The Dutch Republic had also become a haven for persecuted people across Europe. While heretics were being burned at the stake in Spain, the 1579 treaty that created the Netherlands stated that everyone shall remain free in religion, and no one may be persecuted or investigated because of religion. While Jews were barred from entering France or England, thousands of Sephardic refugees from Spain and Portugal lived in Amsterdam, worshipped in the world's largest synagogue, and invested in the trading companies that founded New Netherland and the Dutch East Indies. Catholics, Mennonites, and Lutherans lived peaceably alongside the Calvinist majority. In 1607, the Englishman William Bradford and his band of pilgrims arrived in Holland, where they were welcomed so long as they promised to behave themselves honestly and submit to all the laws. From Leiden, a university city where foreign refugees comprised a third of the population, the pilgrims published pamphlets denouncing King Charles, an activity local officials refused to suppress, even after being requested to do so by the English monarch. But the Netherlands' religious pluralism wasn't for everyone, including the pilgrims. Many of their children, Bradford explained, were drawn away by evil examples, by manifold temptations, and the great licentiousness of the youth of that country, and into extravagant and dangerous courses that got the reins off their necks. The Netherlands was too free. The pilgrims would eventually flee to the American wilderness, where they could exert stronger control over their children's upbringing. Relatively few people, however, wanted to leave the Netherlands for an uncertain life across the Atlantic. There were no armies of desperate paupers willing to be sold off as temporary slaves, no oppressed religious sects seeking a more tolerant environment to nurse their faith. New Netherland, like New France, would be challenged by a shortage of colonists. Those who did come tended to be either adventurers seeking their fortunes, or foreigners with weak ties to the Netherlands who perhaps shared the pilgrims' desire for a simpler, more controllable environment. In 1655, 31 years after its foundation, the colony still had only 2,000 residents. There were only 9,000 when the British took control in 1664, a quarter as many as were living in the younger colonies of New England. New Netherlands' growth was also hindered by its decidedly corporate character. The Dutch founded the colony as a means to prevent the English from dominating the American continent, but they tried to run it as cheaply as possible. Already engaged in Asia, Africa, Brazil, and the Caribbean, the government didn't wish to invest many resources in North America, a relatively low-priority project lacking the obvious economic returns of the spice, sugar, and tea trades. Instead, the Republic's authorities outsourced the project to the private sector, turning governance of its North American colony over to the West India Company. The people of New Netherland would enjoy religious tolerance and considerable economic freedom, but they would not have a Republican government. To the contrary, the West India Company would appoint its own governor and advisory council, who would rule the colony without interference from any sort of elected body. All trade with the mother country had to be carried out on the company's ships, and it had a monopoly over the most profitable commodity, beaver furs. Even so, the company found it difficult to bear the costs of expanding the colony beyond the Manhattan area. To help, it offered wealthy investors the opportunity to create their own aristocratic estates, on the manorial model, farther up the Hudson Valley, in exchange for transporting settlers to New Netherland. The would-be manor lords, or patroons, were granted county-sized parcels of land where they would serve as judge and jury over all civil and criminal proceedings, including capital crimes, literally giving them the power of life and death over their tenants. Most of these patroonships failed because few settlers were willing to become tenant farmers when there was free land for the taking elsewhere, the great Van Rensselaer estate near Albany being the one exception. The patroons themselves often became exceedingly wealthy, but usually through trade. With only a few exceptions, a landed aristocracy did not develop in New Netherland. The result was a colony as tolerant and diverse as the mother country. In 1654, a boatload of penniless Jewish war refugees from the Dutch colony of Brazil was met with hostility from the anti-Semitic governor, Peter Stuyvesant, who called them a deceitful race, and tried to cast them from the colony. His superiors in Amsterdam overruled him, calling his plans unreasonable and unfair, and pointing out that Jewish shareholders had invested a large amount of capital in their company. When Stuyvesant tried to limit Quaker immigration, this new, unheard-of, abominable heresy, the people of Flushing protested, writing that the law of love, peace, and liberty in the States extends to Jews, Turks, that is, Muslims, and Egyptians, Gypsies, which is the glory of the outward state of Holland. Company officials warned the bigoted governor to not force people's consciences, but allow everyone to have his own belief as long as he behaves quietly and legally, gives no offense to his neighbors, and does not oppose the government. Tolerance, they noted, had served the mother country well, and was vital to the success of its colonies. Today, it lies at the heart of what makes New York City possible. While relations with the Indians were generally fair and cordial, this was more the result of Dutch self-interest than of enlightened thinking. Unlike their European rivals on the eastern seaboard, the New Netherlanders remained outnumbered by the Indians throughout the period of Dutch rule. Offending the five tribes of the Iroquois nation would have been not only suicidal, but also bad for business, as they were the source of most of New Amsterdam's fur supply. The weaker Algonquin-speaking tribes of the lower Hudson were another matter. Occupying prime farmland, and, after 1640, possessed a few beaver, the Algonquins were an obstacle to the colony's expansion. Tensions over land provoked a series of bloody wars in the 1640s, 1650s, and 1660s, with terrible bloodshed on both sides. New Netherlanders didn't regard the Indians as servants of the devil. Intermarriage was perfectly legal, but did not particularly value their presence beyond what it meant for the bottom line. The Dutch trait of tolerance was just that. They didn't celebrate diversity, but tolerated it, because they knew the alternative was far worse. The Dutch people, much like those of Champlain's native Saintonge, had internalized the lessons of Europe's horrific and ongoing religious wars, in which many of their countrymen had perished. Insistence on conformity, cultural, religious, or otherwise, was self-defeating, causing strife and undermining trade and business. This begrudging acceptance of difference remains a hallmark of Greater New York City today, where it seems all the cultures, religions, and classes of the world are thrown together onto the same street, wrestling with one another for advantage in the markets of commerce, politics, and ideas. The elite families that came to dominate the region in the late 17th century were founded by a very Dutch type, the self-made man. The founder of the Van Cortlandt dynasty arrived in New Amsterdam as a soldier, became a carpenter, trader, alderman, and, ultimately, the city's mayor. Frederik Philipse was a butcher when he arrived, worked as a pawnbroker and fur trader, and was able to attract the hand of a wealthy widow, Margaret de Vries, who managed the activities of her own merchant vessel. By 1679, he was the wealthiest man in New York, with a plantation in Barbados and a manor house in Yonkers. Jan Ersten van der Bilt arrived as an indentured servant in 1650. His third great-grandson, Cornelius, born on Staten Island, would make the Van der Bilt family one of the wealthiest in history. The first Van Burens were tenant farmers on the Rensselaers Manor. Their sons became independent farmers, and their fifth great-grandson was President of the United States. New Netherland was primarily a commercial society, in which much of the governing elite was associated with the Dutch West India Company. This company was no more moral than its English counterparts. If a commodity was profitable, it was pursued, including trade in captive humans. Indeed, full-on slavery was introduced to what is now the United States not by the gentleman planters of Virginia or South Carolina, but by the merchants of Manhattan. In 1626, while Africans in Tidewater were still being treated as indentured servants, the company imported 11 slaves to address its shortage of laborers. By 1639, there was a slave camp 5 miles north of the city, presumably providing workers to man the company's farms and docks. In 1655, the company's slave ship, Witte Peert, arrived in New Amsterdam from West Africa with 300 slaves, who were sold at public auction, increasing the city's population by 10%. In the last decade before the English conquest, New Amsterdam was rapidly evolving into North America's greatest slave market. Even though most slaves were transported to Tidewater, an estimated 20% of the city's population was of African origin by 1670. Not all were enslaved, however. Some were granted their freedom by their owners, and many company slaves eventually earned half freedom, which allowed them to marry, travel, and own property, while paying a fixed lease on themselves. By the time New Amsterdam became New York, the city already had a multiracial character and multi-generational legacy of slavery. The latter institution would continue to be present in Greater New York right into the 1860s. Bolstered by the slave trade, New Netherland was beginning to flourish when a hostile English fleet arrived in 1664. New Amsterdam was taken by surprise. The two countries were not then at war, and grossly outgunned, not only by the ships in the harbor, but by Yankee rebels from eastern Long Island who marched to Brooklyn ready to loot the city. During a tense standoff, the Dutch negotiated an unusual surrender agreement to ensure the survival of Dutch norms and values. New Netherlanders would keep their business and inheritance laws, property, churches, language, and even their local officials. They could continue to trade with the Netherlands, making New Amsterdam the only city in the world with simultaneous ties to both major trading empires. Most important, religious toleration was ensured. New Netherland would be renamed New York, but its culture carried on. Unfortunately, the new regime also retained New Netherland's autocratic government. The new colony of New York was to be the personal preserve of King Charles's brother and heir, James, Duke of York. Indeed, James himself had organized the surprise attack against the Dutch, the king having already granted him the land. James, a military man with an eye to creating an authoritarian empire, placed all exclusive and legislative power in the hands of his governor. There would be no elected assemblies in the Duke's province. As for the Yankee settlements of eastern Long Island, which pledged allegiance to Connecticut, they would be part of New York, whether they liked it or not. While ignoring the Yankees' protests, James gave two of his war colleagues title to the sparsely populated lands between the Hudson and Delaware rivers, creating the new colony of New Jersey. After a brief 1673-74 episode in which the Dutch briefly recaptured New Netherland in 1673, James released all Dutchmen from the administration, banned the use of the Dutch language in the courts, and garrisoned undisciplined imperial troops throughout the province. The Duke had carte blanche. When he became king a few years later, his autocratic plans for North America would provoke the first American Revolution. Chapter 6. The Colony's First Revolt. While everyone knows that the English-controlled colonies rebelled against the tyrannical rule of their distant king, few realize they first did so not in the 1770s, but in the 1680s. And they did so not as a united force of Americans eager to create a new nation, but in a series of separate rebellions, each seeking to preserve a distinct regional culture, political system, and religious tradition threatened by the distant seat of empire. These threats came in the form of the new King James II, who ascended to the throne in 1685. James was intent on imposing discipline and political conformity on his unruly American colonies. Inspired by the absolutist monarchy of France's King Louis XIV, King James planned to merge the colonies, dissolve the representative assemblies, impose crippling taxes, and install military authorities in the governor's chairs to ensure that his will was obeyed. Had he succeeded, the nascent American nations might have lost much of their individual distinctiveness, converging over time into a more homogeneous and docile colonial society, resembling that of New Zealand. But even at this early stage of their development, only two or three generations after their creation, the American nations were willing to take up arms and commit treason to protect their unique cultures. James wasted little time executing his plans. He ordered the New England colonies, New York and New Jersey, to be merged into a single authoritarian mega-colony called the Dominion of New England. The Dominion replaced representative assemblies and regular town meetings with an all-powerful royal governor, backed by imperial troops. Across Yankeedom, Puritan property titles were declared null and void, forcing landowners to buy new ones from the crown and to pay feudal rents to the king in perpetuity. the Dominion governor seized portions of the town commons in Cambridge, Lynn, and other Massachusetts towns, and gave the valuable plots to his friends. The king also imposed exorbitant duties on Tidewater tobacco and the sugar produced around the recently formed settlement of Charleston. All of this was done without the consent of the governed, in violation of the rights granted all Englishmen under the Magna Carta. When a Puritan minister protested, he was tossed in jail by a newly appointed Dominion judge, who told him that his people now had no more privileges left other than not to be sold for slaves. Under James, the rights of Englishmen stopped at the shores of England itself. In the colonies, the king would do whatever he wished. Whatever their grievances, the colonies probably would not have dared revolt against the king had there not also been serious resistance to his rule back in England. At a time when Europe's religious wars were still in living memory, James had horrified many of his countrymen by converting to Catholicism, appointing numerous Catholics to public office, and allowing Catholics and followers of other faiths to worship freely. England's Protestant majority feared a papal plot, and between 1685 and 1688, three domestic rebellions erupted against James's rule. The first two were put down by royal armies, but the third succeeded through a strategic innovation. Instead of taking up arms themselves, the plotters invited the military leader of the Netherlands to do so for them. Invading from the sea, William of Orange was welcomed by a number of high officials, and even James's own daughter, Princess Anne. Supporting a foreign invader against one's own father may seem a bit odd, but William, in fact, was James's nephew, and was married to his daughter Mary. Outmaneuvered by friends and family alike, James fled into exile in France in December 1688. William and Mary were crowned king and queen, ending a bloodless coup Englishmen dubbed the Glorious Revolution. Because it took months for news of the coup to reach the colonies, rumors of a planned Dutch invasion continued to swirl there throughout the winter and early spring of 1689, confronting the colonials with a difficult choice. The prudent course would have been to wait patiently for confirmation of how events in England played out. A bolder alternative was to defend their societies by rising up against their oppressors in the hopes that William actually had invaded England, that he would be successful, and, if so, that he would look kindly on their actions. Each of the American nations made its own choice, for its own reasons. In the end, the only ones not to opt for rebellion were the young colonies around Philadelphia and Charleston, which, with just a few hundred settlers each, were in no position to engage in geopolitics, even if they wanted to. But many people in Yankeedom, Tidewater, and New Netherland were ready and willing to risk everything for their respective ways of life. Not surprisingly, Yankeedom led the way. With their deep commitment to self-government, local control, and Puritan religious values, New Englanders had the most to lose from King James's policies. The Dominion governor, Sir Edmund Andros, lived in Boston and was particularly eager to bring New England to heel. Within hours of stepping off the boat in Massachusetts, the governor had issued a decree that struck at the heart of New England identity. He ordered Puritan meeting houses opened for Anglican services and took away the New Englanders' charters of government, which the people of Boston described as the hedge which kept us from the wild beasts of the field. Anglicans and suspected Catholics were appointed to top government and militia positions, backed by uncouth royal troops, who, witnesses said, began to teach New England to drab, drink, blasphemy, curse, and damn. Towns were forbidden to use taxpayer funds to support their Puritan ministers. In court, Puritans faced Anglican juries and were forced to kiss the Bible when swearing their oaths, an idolatrous Anglican practice, instead of raising the right hand, as was Puritan custom. Liberty of conscience was to be tolerated, Andros ordered, even as he built a new Anglican chapel in what had been Boston's public burial ground. A people who believed they had a special covenant with God were losing the instruments with which they had executed his will. The Dominion's policies, the inhabitants of Boston concluded, had to be part of a popish plot. Their country, they would later explain, was New England, a place so remarkable for the true profession and pure exercise of the Protestant religion that it had attracted the attention of the great scarlet whore, who sought to crush and break it,